Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arkinall.
How's it going, everyone? Thanks for joining us.
This weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of July 1st, 2024. So I'm going to start off with one that I'm sure a lot of people are I'm not necessarily freaking out about, but I'm sure they're talking about. And it's a vulnerability. I sometimes don't really like talking about vulnerabilities because sometimes my approaches really are just, you patch and you look for signs of exploitation during that, not necessarily like just trying to identify what's vulnerable, because you should know versioning and stuff in your environment already, part of having good inventory. But to say the least, it's called regression, with SSH in there, and it's a remote code execution vulnerability. And what's interesting about this one, it was a vulnerability that existed. There was talks of it in 2006, but it was more of a denial of service type of vulnerability, which is interesting because then by the time it got to 2020, it became a remote code execution vulnerability, which, if anyone ever follows vulnerabilities and why denial of service vulnerabilities can be bad, depending on the type of denial of service. If it's a denial of service that deals with being able to manipulate the heap space and memory or the application's memory space, a lot of times those could lead to remote code execution because they may be able to manipulate and find specific places in that stack or heap in order to drop in code that will then get run. So a lot of times those denial of service are kind of precursors to some of those. But to say the least, it was addressed in 2020. And I guess whatever changes they did to recent updates have reintroduced this vulnerability. And it's a race condition. So what's interesting about that is it, based on how it takes advantage of the code that it's trying to exploit, it needs certain things to happen in a certain way or in a certain, timing for to achieve success there. So looking at some of the POCs that have come out with it, what was interesting is they do have something where they kind of set up some of the parameters, get some data back to get ideas on where they need to potentially upload or modify the heap, but they do have like a counter where they try like 20,000 times and then adjust their timing based on feedback they get from those iterations. So that's just interesting in the fact that it'd be a lot of noise and a lot of packets potentially hitting SSH. I don't know what that looks like specifically on the network from a connection that is, a normal authenticated connection versus someone just trying to do this type of attack. It was something that people are probably worried about and thinking about. And so one of the things I think about when it comes to remote code execution, in the POCs I've seen thus far, they do, have a place where you can try to drop in your payload, but they kind of refer to the payloads as being shell code. A lot of times when people take advantage of, these things where they can, do remote code execution, sometimes they just drop a shell that gives them kind of like that reverse access, and that reverse access or reverse shell will give them root access. So they'll give you the most access on the box with this vulnerability to then do additional things. Now, just because you have that shell access, depending on what kind of server this is, there might not be a lot of other various things an attacker might do after that. A lot of times there's going to be that profiling because they might not know what box they're on. They potentially might move other payloads onto the box. So then you expect W, get, or curl potential activities to then pull in payloads and maybe execute those, which could be additional malware tool sets And then they also maybe they can try to leverage after they kind of get that foothold established of what they're trying to do. Kind of use that box as a beachhead to then further get into the environment. Because when you're looking at SSH, a lot of times, you know, there's not many things that are exposed oftentimes publicly, but there are. I mean, I think they even talked about they did some scans, or someone did some scans that showed a fair amount out there in the wild. But I just want to kind of bring it to everyone's attention. If you haven't looked at this, it's worth looking at. The key things I would focus on is make sure your environment knows where SSH is exposed externally, and potentially internally, just so that you know if someone's inside, they can potentially leverage this beyond your borders. But there's obviously more activity to detect and identify beforehand. But look for that post-exploitation activity on those things that are exposed to see if any of that activity lines up. Yeah, and it's a good read. Check it out. I don't think I mentioned the source, but it's Qualys who actually put out the report, and they put it out today. So, Lee, what did you think when you saw this?
Well, I think the same idea as you, right? We don't think about vulnerabilities or when we talk about vulnerabilities, it's always, well, okay, if they exploited it, what would it look like? Because normally, I'm sure there are exceptions, but normally what happens is that there is this one certain log on the device that's vulnerable that will capture the activity of the exploit, or in the past of some recent vulnerabilities that we saw, you may have to talk to the product creator or developer to access a memory dump to see if it was even yet exploited. So at this point, if you're not auditing those strange locations and bringing those into a SIM or EDR or whatever the case may be, if you're not actively doing memory dumps and stuff like that, you're probably blind to it, right? So, I mean, you can't find this obscure logging locations with every device in your environment, because I feel like that would be just a waste of time, right? Just to wait for something. Second, even if you are auditing those logs, how do you know there's a vulnerability in it? Like, that's something that you aren't aware of yet, especially if these are 0 days. And maybe you got lucky because you just decided to turn it on. But what I found really interesting, and what goes along with it, is the vulnerable versions are actually pretty crazy. And it's kind of like a dance. So if you are checking, make sure you're checking the right block. But it said OpenSSH versions earlier than 4.4 P1 are vulnerable, unless they're patched for CVE-2006-5051 and CVE-2008-4109. If you're running that OpenSSH before that, you probably have a lot more to worry about than just.
Right.
But then the next thing it says versions from 4.4 P1 up to, but not including 8.5 P1, are not vulnerable due to a patch for 2006 or CVE-2006-5051. So from 4.4 to 8 point, whatever was right before 8.5 P1, thanks, Doc. And then the vulnerability resurfaces in versions from 8.5 P1 up to, but not including 9.8 P1. Due to an accidental removal of a critical component in a function. So the fact that they like accidentally passed it by removing this, I mean, not to say that the developers don't know what they're doing, but with so much line of code and people creating things all the time, and the process that it would take to go through all that to make sure it's secure coding, which even if you do have good secure coding in place, there's not a guarantee that you're going to find every single thing, right? So the fact that they somehow, and it seems, I don't know when 9.8 was released, but if you somehow are running on that, then congratulations, because you somehow became not vulnerable and it's safe. But I think it's pretty interesting, especially how it all went down. With the effective versions and all. But yeah, like you said, going back to the whole threat hunting perspective anyways, look for, you know, you got to read about what happens next, not so much is this going to be exploited, and because that'll kind of tell you.
Like, I would not put hunting in quotation marks for looking for this vulnerability. I wouldn't call that the hunting aspect with dealing with this. It really is about, okay, I know how adversaries think, how they operate, and what kind of operating systems that have this vulnerability. So now I know what other traits to look for, right, based on that information. So,
absolutely. It's those behaviors and traits that you're looking at, not so much the exploit. Because then you could tie it back to the exploit eventually and say that's where they got initial access. But yeah.
Cool. So what do you got?
So first up, I have a nice article by the Zscaler. It's on their blog. Kintsugi deploys trans, and I don't know if this is trans latex or trans latex to target South Korean academia. But it was actually a pretty interesting way of doing it. But basically, I'm going to say trans latex. Sorry for that, wrong. But it's designed to steal information from the targets. For cyber espionage, they believe that this is from, or they've attributed to Kintsugi, who comes from the North Korean government, or SNAPT from the North Korean government. And looking at the attack chain, it was the zip archive that had a Windows executable and a decoy document that looked like a file type that they use in South Korea. And whenever the executable was run, which was masqueraded to look like something else, it pulled down a PowerShell script from the attacker's controlled GitHub account that was also discovered, which is, I think they said it was newly discovered GitHub account. But then a shortcut file is created and it does some more discovery stuff and then communicates to the C2 server. Now it does, do some cool, some neat defense evasion in it. But I think the one thing that I found fascinating about this was the simple step of querying a registry key. Now, why I found this interesting is because I actually had to do some research onto what this registry key is. So I'm going to spell this out, or I'm going to list out the registry key. I'm sure we'll put it in the notes, but it's the HKCU, or the current user hive, software, policies, Google Chrome extension install force list. So I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what it, but this, the malware is checking and querying the status of this. Now, if the registry key is not set, what it means is that a user can download, well, pending other permissions, download and install extensions in the Chrome browser. Now, if it is set and is normally, or I believe it's a value of a 1, what happens is that this is now a set registry key, and then there's a value in it that you have to that you have to call out, or you can leave the value empty. But you'll have a URL attached to with a I think it said a 32-bit value. I'm going to check my note. Yeah, 32-letter string that allows you to install this. But what this means is that if it is set, then the apps and extensions are installed silently and without user interaction, and a user can't uninstall them or turn them off. So if they get access, and my mind kind of went two ways here. They could check the registry key, and if it is set, the next step would be privilege escalation and then adding their own 32-string value and the URL to it so that they could silently install this this extension that steals their information. If they check it and it's unset, then that would mean that they would have to privilege escalate or find a way to abuse possibly group GPU policies or group policies and set it that way, or find a way to set this registry key. Because because they want persistence, right? They want this extension to stay there. And if they install it, first of all, they can't turn off, can't uninstall it, and it'll just sit there. And maybe the user doesn't even know about it simply because it's just added to it. And I don't know about you, Foley, but I have a couple extensions. And if you don't pin them to your Chrome browser, you won't see them listed. So right. Say someone does have a bunch of those pinned, but then they have a bunch of extensions otherwise, you have to click on the little puzzle piece and it'll show you the list of extensions. So if you can hide in there without them noticing, and then they never know you turned it on, and then you can't turn it off, I mean, that just is a unique form of persistence for a program.
Yeah, and I've never seen that before.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen malicious extensions installed for like crypto mining and stuff like that, but as a persistent mechanism, I just thought this was really, really interesting. And I like that. And I'm always excited when I can learn about a new registry key that's actually relevant. I mean, we can research all the registry keys that are out there, but there's like thousands of them.
Every application adds a whole new list of registry keys, right? Then just like for, you know, Chrome.
Right. Yeah, that's what really stuck out to me. So what was your interesting take on this?
So one, I think I figured out how to say it's not translate text. It, since it masquerades as a Google Translate extension, I think it's translate extension. That's kind of what it's supposed to stand for.
So I was both on wrong. Well, no one's really surprised.
Yeah. No, it took me a minute too, because I was like, no, I kind of liked your version better. It sounded more interesting, but
I like the French version.
Yeah.
And latex.
But yeah, I've never seen the extension persistence in this manner. One, it also highlights, because I think the targeting group were educational entities, right? And a lot of EDU or universities and stuff, they do lock down browsers and things in labs and within the environment. It's funny, like it's interesting that you'll see more lockdown of things like applications and browsers in a university, but not in a workplace. But that's why I think the person who's setting up this attack knew about this because of his intended targets and the testing and understanding of these things. But the other thing is just, it was interesting how it added to every single website, it added HTML code to the site dynamically. So every time you went to a new site, it added something to the page, which I thought was kind of cool. It made me think of kind of how like Burp Suite and all those like proxy types of attacks where you can kind of control what's being passed and handled. So kind of built into the extension itself. And I'm sure other extensions, that's kind of how they work. But it's something where if you're able to get source codes from a page and you didn't know the extension was there, you might be able to spot some of those things yourself. But also, it's kind of cool. Like it had a bunch of different listeners based on how it operated. So anytime the cookie got updated with a specific site, it would change and notify based on those. If there was a new tab opened or a tab updated, it would know about that and send that information. And then anytime there's email addresses or passwords put into fields, it would try to grab those as well. And it did screenshots, I think like every 30 seconds or something like that of the pages that people were on. So it was just a great collection method, I think, especially when your target is really just information. So I thought that was really cool. But yeah, the registry key, I think, was the biggest piece here. Because I've never really dealt with, malicious extensions other than identifying them and deleting them. But like, what are some of the mechanisms they may do outside of the application? In this case, the registry key, right? So you have some more system specific stuff you can actually look for, which was kind of cool to learn about. So, yeah.
That's part. Like, normally the registry keys we see a lot in the reports and stuff are the auto run registry key or Windows Defense. Or Windows Defender exclusion registry path, right? Like when people are modifying that. But to see this come out and target a specific browser, like you said, pretty interesting.
Well, I think what's interesting about this too, everyone talks about when you deploy software in an environment, oh, you need to deploy and make all these setting changes to make it secure, right? A lot of the setting changes are just in a registry. So if there is a setting that you can disable potentially, right, outside of the application, then you can change how the application works so that you may be able to take advantage of something else, right? So granted, if you have that kind of access to change that registry, then maybe you have enough access to do what you want to do, but maybe the application gets you additional access because of how it connects outside, you know, of, or how it talks back, or how, you know, whatever. I don't know this, all the scenarios, but there might be a scenario there. And so kind of understanding that the registry is kind of how things are supposed to run, or how things are set up to run too. So you can learn a lot about applications, as well as maybe those applications can be taken advantage of the same way.
Hey, I don't know if it's a good thing, but looking at the default value, that it's unset. Now, that could mean two things. I mean, that gives the user the ability to do whatever they want, turn anything off they want, remove it. A little less hardened, but I feel like if an attacker came in and tried to install something, then there might have been like a pop-up, or, you know, the user be made aware. Whereas on the other side, if you set it, then you're kind of taking all the eyes off it and relying on that administrator, whoever's dealing with it, to say, you know, maybe they check once a week to see if all the registry key values are still the way it is, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But I don't know if that improves things. Like, yeah, the security wise, but if the adversary if that's something you don't check regularly, I don't know. I guess it goes back to
practice and monitor, right? You know, because if they don't change a lot, you're not going to create a lot of noise, but you're creating some auditing around configuration. So you could do that. But something to note, though, is the registry keys that exist in the registry aren't all the keys that actually exist. So there's a lot of things, if they're set to a default value and they're not specifically defined as the default value, the key is invisible. And the only reason for that is for optimization, because everything in the registry hives gets loaded when a computer boots up and everything goes. So if every possible configuration was listed there, it would slow things down. So that's like intentional, but that means there's hidden keys, you know, quote unquote, that you don't know exists. And you kind of have to have that knowledge based on documentation and sources elsewhere to know that there are keys that control specific things too. So registry is an animal, but you know, there's a lot of really interesting information in there.
I think Windows should push out a certified registry master certification where you can just like ramble off flashcards.
Like, configure your entire environment only with registry. Like, oh, okay.
That, I think that would like go back to the days of like the original programmers.
Yeah, maybe we feel that way.
You'd have one person that knows it all.
So yeah, it was a good one. So the next one I wanted to jump into, and it's only because we kind of talked about vulnerabilities earlier, and then this kind of popped up with some of the things I was looking through, and I was like, you know, this is interesting because it kind of pertains to vulnerability management strategy, but it was another HelpNet Security. I think I've talked about some of the reportings in the past too, but they'll do a good job of finding reports and then pulling out highlights. And this one's titled, you know, 75% of new vulnerabilities exploited within 19 days. And then there's more to the article than just that. But basically, you know, one of the things that they talked about that I thought was actually an interesting bullet point, because I always think about how vulnerability programs have been managed in the past. And it's like, well, we can't deal with all the vulnerabilities, so we either do an assessment of which ones we care about, and we typically deal with like the highs and the criticals, right? Because that would be a better optimization of our time. Well, in 2023, they had data that said that nearly half of all the newly discovered vulnerabilities during that year were either high or critical. So now the strategy for like, we're just going to deal with high and critical vulnerabilities is now pushing the bucket's getting so big that you got to have a different approach than that itself, potentially, based on your resources. And, you know, when we talked about coding practices, and with the previous vulnerability, like, hey, you know, shows vulnerability existed, it got coded out, then it came back. maybe people are getting better at coding, so the lower vulnerabilities are going away, but the criticals and highs are harder to catch. You know, I don't know. I don't know why that there's that shift in that number. But, you know, that's a hard problem to address. And then the other thing was they said that based on looking at mean time to exploit, they said in 2023, it was 44 days. Right. But now they're starting to see that, you know, 25% of the vulnerabilities exploited were actually exploited the same day, which is tough, right? When you, you know, identify which ones do we need to get to and patch immediately, and what does that look like, and how quickly can things be patched? What's downtime look like for that too? But then they also, when they, you know, the title was said, well, it's staggering 75% within 19 days. And I was first reading that, I was like, well, that's 100% between 25, but that 25%, same day falls into that 19 days, right? So it's kind of inclusive there. So, you know, that's just something when you think about strategies and dealing with vulnerabilities. If vulnerabilities are being hit, the one thing to note about vulnerabilities is they're really just the first step. So in an attack, a lot of times, I mean, they obviously cycles repeat. So it could be as you get in, you use more vulnerabilities. I get that. But you know, I think of vulnerabilities kind of like a new phishing when it comes to threat hunting, where there's going to be things always coming out. And that's why you kind of have that defense in depth. That's why you have detection rules. That's why you have patch management to try to close as many doors as you can. But there's going to be doors that you can't close fast enough, or that you might not be able to close at all, right? And so this kind of leads to that strategy. Well, what's your next step strategy? Well, if you're looking for common post-exploitation activities that usually follow vulnerabilities in general, now you at least have an advantage to say, okay, we weren't able to close all the doors we could, but for remote code execution, like we just talked about, what are the common traits to follow that type of vulnerability versus maybe another type of vulnerability? What actions am I continuously hunting for? So that if a vulnerability that even doesn't even get announced, right? Maybe an attacker finds a vulnerability that isn't public, so you have no idea to even look for it. That's where like that threat hunting piece comes in, right? You can constantly be looking for, and then if you're proactively looking for those post-exploitation activities, then that will help you understand what is also normal. So when there is a huge shift where all of a sudden you're seeing this kind of activity on a server or a box that you've never seen previously, well, is that box publicly exposed anywhere? If it's internal, what is it exposed to know, well, why are things happening on that box that weren't happening before that mimic this behavior? Those are huge insights. And if you, you know, aren't doing that regularly, then you can't develop those insights. You just see that as, you know, normal. So that's really one of the reasons I thought this was really interesting, because it kind of changed the paradigm for how I understood a lot of people deal with vulnerabilities. They really wanted to leverage the weight of criticality, and there's a lot more to it than that. And I know mature programs also have like what's critical mean to us based on where things sit. I get it. But yeah, if you can't just hit the mass patch button, you know, you got to have strategies to deal with this. And I think threat hunting helps a lot with the risks of that.
Yeah. So I know we keep saying vulnerabilities and threat hunting in the same sense, and they're not, you know, not saying that they're related. You know, we're talking about how hunting for vulnerability isn't threat hunting. And I mean, I know we push threat hunting because that's who we are. But the idea of the processes, or if you think about vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. how they've been found in the past, and what defenders are up against, is if you think about a nation state actor, or APT group, or some large organization that has enough time and resources that they can sit there and poke and poke and poke at devices, hardware, software, firmware. That, I mean, that's that time and effort that organizations don't. They don't have that. So if you're relying on these devices, you're doing basic vulnerability scanning, if you will, or management, where mm-hmm. you check to see, you know, once a day, once a week, whatever you choose, you scan all your devices and get some information on it, and it tells you what, you know, what version is running on them, so that if there is you know, you have that data ready. So if you have that, if their vulnerability does come up, you can check your spreadsheet and say, well, what's going on? Now, the reason threat hunting, and I feel, and people may disagree with me, but threat hunting bridges that gap between the time and effort needed to find those vulnerabilities. Because once again, and I'm not saying that threat hunting is going to find vulnerabilities, but if you see that, you keep talking about the behaviors and the tactics, techniques, and procedures associated with initial actions, associated with the next steps of exploiting a vulnerability. If you can put time and money into threat hunting and have people proactively looking through these logs, proactively looking for weird things, you know, coming from strange sources, then you can potentially, and I'm not saying you can identify a vulnerability, but you could say, well, why is this device, why is all the traffic leading back to this device? That's very strange. If we look at the data, it's never done that before. And then figure it out. Now, once again, I'm not saying you'll get a CVE out of it, but knowing your environment and learning your environment is a byproduct of good threat hunting. Being able to identify this strange chain of processes that are coming from, or traffic coming from, devices that shouldn't be doing that or have never done it before is what threat hunting is about. And so maybe you see that. Maybe you see something's happening and it does eventually tie to a vulnerability. I think that would close that gap. I'm not saying it would fix it, but at the same time, it would give you an upper hand than just the normal vulnerability management.
Yeah, I kind of think of like threat hunting when you look at a good network map, right? You can see how everything communicates in your environment. And even those things are hard to stay up to date, but threat hunting almost has the stacks of what's operating on top of that network map, what processes and things happen in your organization on top of what's operating on top. I mean, like you can kind of see things from like a multidimensional way for how the environment works. And it'd be really cool if someone could actually map that out visually, but you know, very few people get the ability to actually kind of understand or see it that way too. So,
Yeah. I mean, that's the case as well. Cause I mean, with threat hunting doesn't just come, it's kind of just something you do, right? You need the tools, you need the logs, you need the audits. So it's a big lift from zero, but still valuable.
Cool. So what do you got up next?
So I got something that I think you'll like.
Yeah, I did.
Okay. I knew it. And eventually as I scrolled down to the bottom, I knew why.
That's exactly right.
So, and ironically, this is like the best of both our worlds, or I guess history. So this is a GitHub. It's an account on GitHub. It's jpcertcc, and the tool is called Logon Tracer. Now, if you've ever run into me or heard me talk about any presentations or whatever the case may be, the first steps I took towards threat hunting was through Sysmon. I found out what Sysmon was through the jpcert tool analysis guide that they did. And basically, they took a bunch of living off land binaries. They put different logging, like different auditing. So process create, so you got your 4.6.8.8s from Windows. You got Sysmon event code 1, some other PowerShell stuff. And then they executed it. They executed living off land binary, and they just looked at what logs were produced. So that's where I found Sysmon. But to come back to something that blends in a very specific type of analysis, and I guess when I say specific, not maybe specific is the proper term, but it's a narrow window. It's looking at malicious logons by visualizing and analyzing Windows Active Directory event logs. So we got a 4.6.2.4, which is successful logon, 4.6.2.5, logon failure. You got 4.7.6.9, which is the Kerberos authentication and or TGT request, the ST or the service ticket request. Then you have 4.7.6 NTLM authentication, 4.6.7.2 assigns special privileges. If you didn't get that, because I just list them all, they're on the website. They list them there, so it's very useful. But they provided this picture, just a screenshot of Log on Tracer, which looked familiar at first, and I thought of you, Poli. And some background. It is Neo 4j run. And I recognize it because Poli did some work, and I think you may have mentioned this a podcast or two ago, but Poli did some work with Bloodhound and sitting on, and he took all the data and threw it through on Neo 4j, looking at nested privileges, so like nested privileged accounts. Well, what this does is it takes a user and it maps it to, well, at this point, what I can see is an IP, and it lists the event logs that are associated with the log. So what looks normal right now is you see a 4624, so you see a successful log on, and then you see a 4768, so you see the Kerberos authenticator, or the TGT ticket being request, or TGT request, and then you see the service ticket. And that's just a little bubble, and you see it coming from an IP, and you see it to a user. Well, as you scroll around, then you start to see something that looks a little strange, but you can see what's different from the other account. So there's a sysadmin account that has a bunch of other IPs tied to it, a different device, has a bunch of different, event codes as well. But the whole idea is that they're investigating, or they're mapping out these event codes that are tied to these usernames. So you could possibly, like, even if you look at it, just going through, you see, okay, there's a good one-to-one relationship here with this account. There's a good one-to-one relationship with this account. Oh, here's a one-to-many. That might be strange. Oh, no, let's take a look at the privileges. That's normal. But if you would think about how lateral movement works, if they're using the same privileged account to bounce from device to device to device, and this has never been done before, you'd think that that would stand out like right away. And this actually took me to their presentation, or the article that they put out that was titled "Detecting Lateral Movement in APTs: Analysis Approach on Windows Event Logs." Now, they said the author's name, and this was actually back from 2016, the presentation was. So that just shows you how not relevant, or how it's still powerful, right? But this is from the ICS Security Response Group. So going through it, they're definitely tying this more to industrial control systems, not just user or normal enterprise accounts. But you can imagine how you could adopt it as well. But it's a really good read. They tell you the whole idea behind it, what the motivation was, and how you could benefit from it. But, I mean, it was really interesting. I'm always looking for new tools. I'm always looking for new just things to play with to learn the environment better. Because, like, this could provide you, going back to threat hunting, this could provide you with that baseline in an easier fashion of, who uses what IPs, who uses what devices, and you could possibly easily identify strange logins, or like, hey, why is this user logging into this device? They've never done that before. Or you see multiple accounts bouncing around. It's just a really cool tool. I'm going to throw it to our engineering team to see if we can get or I can spend the time and do it myself. But
I think you just got to extract the logs, right? And then you can run it through the tool, from my guess. So if you just do like a copy of the DC logs, because you need DC logs for some of these things, I think you might be able to just then push it through the tool, have it ingest it, and then you can kind of see what it looks like. Obviously, like, yeah, you want Neo4j and stuff built in. I don't know if it does use the JavaScript driver, so I don't know if that is like a way for it to do it live, like as data grows, you're still collecting and analyzing. But yeah, like it's interesting because that was the one thing I was doing when I was trying to use Bloodhound to determine where people were in environments. I relied on the ability that when I did the scan at that time. It was more like a batch collect to look, were there any active sessions other than the user that I was using to basically leverage to scan the environment. So it wasn't necessarily 100% consistent, because if someone logged in for 10 minutes somewhere and I was scanning, you know, 20 minutes before that, I would miss when they touched the box, versus when you have these logs in, logs from a DC, or locally, depending on where you're grabbing, you definitely have the absolute, you know, positive that someone was there or logged in there, which gives you a lot more visibility and higher fidelity, obviously. So this is kind of cool. And I think Bloodhound, there was ways where people have figured out how to ingest some of the server logs to be able to get where people logged in before. So they try to analyze something similar, but I mean, sometimes too, with now with Bloodhound, there's so much data there, it gets overwhelming if you've ever seen a lot of data in a graph database. So this is kind of a cool too, like single point solution where you're just looking at something specific that you can wrap your head around very quickly. You can see patterns very easily. And that's why I like when, especially with like human interaction with environments, I think these types of tools help out a lot. Because we're not as predictable as humans, right? Sometimes we do random things based on what's needed. So, you know, you might see these random behaviors, but you'll see like hard to find patterns, what we do on a most day-to-day basis. So kind of like threat hunting, right? Where we're looking at human behavior and outliers of human behavior, or, you know, with the consistent part of human behavior. So yeah, it's a really cool tool. So I'm glad that you brought this to my attention. More things for me to think on, dwell on.
I like they said it's also possible to display event logs in chronological order, which is, I mean, it's important in the investigation, but if you're just starting out and you have this tool, and you're just trying to learn the environment, then you can learn like what that looks like. And if you have that basic foundation of knowledge, as soon as you go to like, if you get one, you know, once you get hired or something, you can bring that to the table and say like, let's take a look at what these event logs look like. Is there anything that is not in order like this? And I know Splunk has a what's the transform command?
Is it transcript?
Transaction.
Transition. Transaction.
Yeah. So you can define what the start event code is and the end event code is, and you can say, find me all the events that are like this. I think there probably possibly be a way to, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but to negate that or look at the opposite, or to say, you know, if it's not in this order,
right,
what can you find anything like that? Of course, you know, relying on timestamps and stuff, and hopefully you have the visibility, but it's just an interesting thought process of, hey, here's the normal event 4624, you get the 768, the 769. And then, you know, if there's any special privileges or anything, but yeah, anything out of that order might, you know, indicate that something's up.
Yeah, and be able to look at data that way too is helpful, because just learning protocols, like I remember just like looking at, well, how does SMB work, or how does, you know, Kerberos work or whatever. When you're able to see the events around it in a kind of a chronological step, then it starts to make sense where you're like, okay, so I know these are all the components. I know, then you learn what these components are, and then it all, then you kind of have a good understanding of when you start actually investigating certain protocols or things about protocols, things will stand out more. You have like a, at least a baseline of what to expect in the data. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So I don't really have a super exciting one to end on, but it's just interesting that these things still happen. So it was something I actually picked up on the register, and it was, Australia evil twin Wi-Fi airline attack. And so basically police allege an evil twin of an in-flight Wi-Fi used to steal passengers' credentials. It's interesting. Like I've heard about some security researchers who were just displaying like how easy this was, because, you know, you go up in the airplane, especially in the airplane, I think they actually found things at airports as well. And I think some security researchers were basically saying, hey, yeah, I can basically, if people don't turn off their phones like they're instructed to, put them in airplane mode, and there's obviously going to be no Wi-Fi access. So these phones will constantly be looking and crawling. Like, is there Wi-Fi? Is there Wi-Fi? Because they don't, you know, the phones aren't smart enough to know that they can't connect. The security researchers would just put their phone in a hotspot and name it like Starbucks or something. And anyone that's been to a, you know, a public Wi-Fi access to the Starbucks, when their phone sees that, they'll try to join it because it's like a known name that they've connected to before, kind of thing. And they have seen, you know, people take pictures like, yeah, like 15 connect them my hotspot, which is really just my phone. And, you know, they weren't distributing internet, but they can just show how easy it is to, you know, get people to connect to you that way when people aren't thinking about it.
I think I'd be a little worried if we're midair and I see a Starbucks hotspot.
Yeah. And it's just funny because, you know, some people, and then those types of access points don't require sometimes any interaction, right? Like once you know the network and it sees something that's like the network, you know, these things will connect. So yeah, you might not need as much interaction, but either way, it was interesting that someone was actually trying to leverage this technique because, you know, a lot of, unless they're doing true man in the middle on top of this, you know, there's a lot of data that you wouldn't be able to see, based on how a lot of, you know, security, with secure sites and, encryption things have really helped. But obviously when you look at some new devices that do this evil twin stuff, they obviously kind of set up a proxy. So you'll start getting like cert warnings and errors, right? That will alarm you to like, hey, there's something wrong with this cert. But a lot of people don't really know how to interpret that or even why that exists. So it's just a matter of like, oh, well, I want to proceed. Click the button to proceed. And you're like, okay, well, I'm going where I want to go. And all you're basically doing is letting someone broker that access so that they see everything in clear text. But then when they talk to the official site, it goes encrypted. So they're able to basically see what you're passing to that site. And that's how they can leverage this a lot of times. And then when I found this, it was pretty quickly where, you know, a guy at Intel 471 that we work with, Jeremy Kirk, was actually talking on one of Australia's, I think, radio shows about this attack. And he said something that was, oh yeah, the other thing that I thought was interesting was, you know, how he mentioned a method to try to steal just initial credentials to things that you might be interested in that I hadn't thought about. And that was, you know, you go to a hotel room, and this is kind of his example, you know, you used to like, you have to put in your hotel room number and your last name typically to get access to the free Wi-Fi or the Wi-Fi provided by the hotel. Well, when you're in a public area and say you make it look like you have to log in with your Google single sign-on, because we're so used to seeing that single sign-on approach where you log in with your Google account or some sort of social media account to access things in general, some people might not think twice when like, oh, I'm trying to get that Wi-Fi. Oh, I need to sign in with my single sign-on with Google and then I get access. They can create that splash page as an evil twin. So you're like, oh, this is how I get access to the internet. And boom, that's how they capture things without having to do any sniffing or man in the middle techniques necessarily. You're just kind of creating that front page before, or that capture page before they actually go any further. And he talked about that. I thought that was actually a really interesting approach to how this could be leveraged in today's era, right? Because the evil twin has been an old attack. I mean, since Wi-Fi has kind of been around, I think it's kind of been around too, right? So that goes back quite some time. And like I said, I thought a lot of our security tooling would actually prevent this from being a thing or not worth the effort much anymore. But apparently, there's still ways to get information or things that people want. So guess this hasn't really completely gone away.
Yeah,
so I just thought it was interesting.
It just seemed like all the cybersecurity awareness training and stuff like that, like, it seems like this is just like the worst case scenario, right? Or mm-hmm. Not the worst case, but it actually happened. Like, this is a great example of why you don't do it. Like, this is the use case of the century. They said that AFP found a portable wireless access device, a laptop and a mobile phone in his hand luggage. Like, I've seen like Raspberry Pis, you know, or the size of those things. I'm just curious. I mean, I'm guessing the dude wasn't walking around with antennas sticking around everywhere. But it's just interesting that, first of all, I'm interested that this happened. I don't know where else you carry it, but then, you know, taking a look at it, it says that they secured a warrant and searched and arrested him, and they found similar activities at locations linked to the man's previous employment. So you wonder, like, this dude has been doing it for a while, clearly.
Yeah.
Like, something that you wonder how many user, you know, credentials he had, passwords, and kind of makes you worry about, like, you know, that insider threat, right? The disgruntled employee kind of mentality. Now, or just, you know, grabbing, you know, whatever information they wanted. And going back to the hotel, like, single sign-on things, if you think about, like, that, right? If you think about that process, what do you think, like, if that, you know, going to Black Hat, as usual, how many rooms are in Mandalay Bay? There's a lot, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What are the chances of you creating, like, a script or something to say, I'm going to cycle through all the room numbers, and I'm going to enter the username as Smith. Like, now, this is not like an account.
There's a possibility, right? Yeah.
Right. Like, it, and I'm not, and once again, I'm kind of sidestepping this. That's not really a vulnerability to, you know, steal credentials and stuff. That's more of gaining free Wi-Fi.
We also like proving, like, that it's not a real control, right?
Exactly. Right, exactly. Yeah. Nothing stopping me from saying I'm a top bully, I'm in room this, and I want free access. But yeah, be careful out there. This is the, like I said before, it's a great use case of why you should actually pay attention to these things. I learned that it called installing a VPN. I have a feeling that not everyone has those on their devices. But yeah.
Yeah, the VPN really helps you just get past the man in the middle piece, because you've already connected all the way out past it, or going through it in a way where they can't see and intercept any parts of it, at least in most scenarios. But yeah, like, I think, like, what you said was a good point, was for definitely for awareness training purposes, you know, for these types of things that I think are easy for people to understand from a cyber attack, because there's like a physical element. Someone's putting things that, you know, in place that are going to broadcast Wi-Fi, which people are very familiar with, and how this is an ongoing thing and how far it's stretched, and what's the risk associated with it. I think it's a great thing for awareness. Kind of get people on board with just being careful, and just, you know, whatever you do it for a purpose. I'll just do it out of a, like, quick convenience or whatever you do with your devices. So yeah. I think that ends some of the talking points here. I want to make sure to do a call out. One, we keep mentioning, but you've got your training at Black Hat, right? A beginner's guide to threat hunting. There's early registration for discounted costs still available. You just got to get in before July 19th. And then you also have a workshop coming up, hunting for command and control. And you're going to be working with Jorge Rodriguez, the director of ransomware here at Intel 471. And that is July 31st, from 12 to 1 PM Eastern Standard Time. Do you want to make any comments or mentions on what that's about?
Yeah. Since, you know, I'm just one researcher, right? Now that we've been, acquired by Intel 471, and we have access to these new level of experts, why not bring them in and let them do the talking, where I can do the threat hunting? Is that, and it's a more reputable person for you. It's not just me doing some research. These are people that are in the trenches, dealing with it all the time, and the real experts. So I asked Jorge. He was very gracious to say, yeah, let's take some time, do it, and we're working on that. But it's going to be like our normal workshops, just with a lot more added value coming from command and control side. We're going to, you know, have the two hunts. We're going to step through the data. We're going to have the challenge. You can earn your badge, but I hope everyone sees the value that we're bringing to it once we get there. So I'm really excited about this one.
Cool, cool. So with that, that kind of closes out this week's edition. So I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that closes out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of July 1st, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.